There is less than 1 month to go before college football season officially opens. One of the first big games will feature the Oregon Ducks and LSU Tigers on September 3rd. In the meantime, the head of the NCAA is holding a get-together for a bunch of college presidents, and commentator Frank DeFord is highly skeptical of that meeting.
Next week, at some place in Indianapolis where time has been instructed to stand still, Mark Emmert, president of the NCAA, will convene what is being called, without irony, a retreat. Assembled will be about 50 college presidents, pledged, it seems, to make sure that college athletics continue to remain firmly in the past in the antiquated amateur hours. The avowed purpose is about, quote, protecting and enhancing the integrity of intercollegiate athletics, which is the equivalent, say, of upholding the gold standard of the government of Somalia. Will there be just one president among the 70 with the courage to suggest that the empire has no wardrobe, that it just doesn't work anymore? Emmert should certainly know. Both colleges whose presidential mansions he graced, LSU and the University of Washington, have been punished by the NCAA. But, of course, so will many of the presidents be coming from athletically convicted campuses. It's certainly worth highlighting that the two prime incumbent NCAA champions, Auburn in football, UConn in basketball, are both current offenders. UConn convicted, Auburn already a serial cheat under investigation once again. If the retreat would only admit that the reason integrity has flown the coop is because it is impossible to maintain the fiction that billion-dollar entertainment industries, which is what ticket sales, concessions, and TV contracts make college football and basketball to be, simply cannot logically exist when everybody is making money but the entertainers themselves. Never mind fairness. It's against human nature. The system obliges hypocrisy and mandates deceit. Yet a stated purpose of the retreat is to maintain amateurism, even as more and more observers and insiders, including coaches, have changed their minds and concluded that the NCAA must acknowledge that the 19th century really did end some time ago. The NCAA claims that amateurism equates to purity. That's a canard. There is simply no proof of that. Otherwise, we would have amateur musicians, painters, and writers, and art would flourish pristine as never before. The NCAA's stated defense for athletic penury is, quote, student athletes should be protected from exploitation. Hear, hear! But right now, it's the NCAA member colleges which exploit football and basketball players. Would there be just one president at the retreat who would speak the truth and acknowledge that the only true reason for amateurism in big-time college sport is because it allows colleges to get something for free with which to amuse the paying students and fleece the wealthy alumni?
Commentator Frank DeFord. He joins us each week from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Much economic news is grim this summer, but not all. Parts of the upper Midwest have seen a rush for a natural resource. It's silica sand, used in fracking, a growing method for extracting natural gas. Harvest Public Media's Kathleen Masterson visited an Iowa sand mine.
Here in northeast Iowa, where the undulating farm fields spill into 300-foot bluffs overlooking the Mississippi River, the Patterson family ran a grain business for decades. They stored the grain in old, unused mine tunnels carved into the cliffs and loaded it onto barges to ship downriver. They pretty much ignored the sandstone all around them. But then one day, owner Kyle Patterson got a phone call.
We decided to open up the mine because of being requested by a fracking company they asked us to supply sand for frack.
So with a nudge from the natural gas industry, Patterson sold his grain biz and opened up Patterson's Sand Company. And he's not the only one to jump into the business. Sandstone deposits are plentiful and accessible across the upper Midwest and in Texas and Oklahoma. They're reopening or ramping up production to meet the huge demand. But why can't the natural gas industry get enough of this sand?
This sand actually has a lot of the properties that they covet. So they are descending upon all these areas to provide this particular sand unit for their shale gas fracking operations.
Iowa State University geologist Bill Simpkins says the industry is using silica sand because of its unique spherical shape and incredible toughness. To extract natural gas bound up in shale rock, energy companies drill thousands of feet down and then blast pressurized water and chemicals into the shale to fracture it.
And the role of the sand is to keep the fractures open.
Other materials can do the same job, but sand is the cheapest. According to U.S. Geological Survey data, production of frac sand has more than quadrupled since 2000. Back at Pattison Sand Company in Iowa, business has been booming. Over the past 6 months, the company has hired 50 new workers. To enter the mine, you have to drive a diesel truck, because gas is too combustible, down a switchback road that winds its way to the bottom of the 300-foot bluff to an opening carved into the cliff's side.
And we're going into the south entrance of the mine. Gotta put my hard hat on.
These are the pillars, you know, these squares that are left in place.
That's Beth Reagan, the environmental permit coordinator for Pattison Sand. She points to the 55 square foot pillars of rock the miners leave to hold up the ceiling as we drive through the crypt-like honeycomb chambers.
Yeah, and what you're hearing are the ventilation fans.
After decades of using the mines just to store grain, sand is flying out the door. Pattison ships as many as 45 rail cars full of sand each day. A back-of-the-envelope calculation shows that could bring in more than $100,000 a day. Tom Dolly of the U.S. Geological Survey says this sand fetches a much higher price when used for fracking than for construction or even making glass bottles.
There's considerable variation in price. But yeah, frack is going to be over double what you would see for glass container price.
In Iowa alone, the Pattison mine could easily have enough sandstone to last 10 years. That's a lot, considering that to meet fracking demand, it's running 24/7 all year long. For NPR News, I'm Kathleen Masterson.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Relief from the resolution of the debt crisis didn't last long. Congress has finished its game of chicken over raising the federal debt ceiling, but the battle shook world markets and grim economic reports keep coming in. NPR's Tom Gelton reports on the challenges ahead.
Over the last several weeks, Washington has been so focused on the wrangling over the debt ceiling that other economic issues went largely unheeded. Turns out the U.S. economy this year hasn't been performing nearly as well as we thought it was. The GDP barely grew in the first two quarters. Manufacturing is in worse shape than we realized. U.S. consumers actually cut their spending last month for the first time in nearly 2 years. When President Obama emerged from the White House yesterday to comment on the approval of a new debt ceiling, his message was essentially, don't get your hopes up, the economy is wounded.
Pretty likely that the uncertainty surrounding the raising of the debt ceiling for both businesses and consumers has been unsettling and just one more impediment to the full recovery that we need.
In fact, even as the president was speaking, Wall Street was tanking. So were markets in Europe, which is struggling with a huge debt crisis of its own. Little wonder no one wants to buy stocks, says Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff.
When everyone sees that global growth is slowing down, it's not just the U.S., we're also seeing China and Europe slowing down, they go, oh no, it's going to be harder than ever to dig our way out of this mess.
Just last year, prospects seemed brighter. After the financial crisis, the global economy rebounded, but that growth has now stalled in ways that remind us how the global economy is interwoven. China, for example, has been booming in part because of demand for its products in the U.S. and Europe. But Kenneth Rogoff points out that with U.S. and European consumers and businesses cutting back on their spending, even China gets hurt.
Although it's still growing, China's not collapsing at all, it's notably slowing, and it's being affected by the rest of the world. And all of these things connect. So we're seeing all the major regions of the world slow down, and it's not clear where growth is going to come from in the coming quarters.
Rogoff, the co-author of a book on the history of financial crises, points out that a slowdown like this is typical after a big financial crisis. In working so hard to get banks to lend again and consumers and businesses to spend again, governments drive themselves deep into debt. Cornell University economist Ishwar Prasad points out that government debt has become a burden for all the big Western economies.
And the high levels of government debt that exist in virtually every advanced economy are going to be a real drag on their growth.
Instead of promoting economic activity, those governments have to focus on financing their debt. Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, they're all having trouble getting banks to loan them what they need. And that prospect has investors here worried as well with regard to the U.S. future. It adds up to economic trouble for much of the developed world, and also to some realignments. The new economies, the emerging market countries, are in relatively better shape. Those that export to the advanced countries are affected by some of their export markets drying up, but Prasad points out that consumers in those countries, China for example, are making up some of the difference. Plus, Prasad says, many of these new economies got their own budget deficits under control years ago, leaving them freer now to do more stimulus spending.
Most of the emerging markets have a lot more space in terms of their policies to prime the pump a little bit if needed to stoke their economies.
So the global economic landscape is shifting, and not in ways that benefit the U.S. or Europe. Economists say the powerhouses of the past could struggle for years to return to the prosperity they knew previously, even as new economies rise up to challenge them. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
A Chinese state media giant is capturing headlines in the United States as well as attention from tourists. And that's our last word in business today. High profile. The Xinhua News logo is now glowing on a 60 by 40 foot billboard in New York City's Times Square. The sign sits atop flashing ads for Prudential, Coca-Cola, and Samsung, making it one of the most visible billboards in the world. Few Americans may be familiar with the Chinese-run news service, but the agency has been doing other things to get attention in this country, including beefing up its U.S. reporting. There's no word, though, on what Xinhua is paying for its prime advertising real estate in New York. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West.